This is series 7 of Events That Made Me, from boardroom to box office, and I am Liz Taylor. Joan Rivers once said, "I don't exercise. If God had wanted me to bend down, he would have put diamonds on the floor." And so, what better way to introduce today's guest, the sixth generation of a jewellery dynasty that is Boodles. It is my pleasure to say hello to Jodie Wainwright.
Very nice to be with you this morning.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And I'm very excited about this because I am a jewellery girl. All my guests share four events that had a significant effect on their journey. And so I'm actually going to start with the second one that you gave me to open our conversation, because in the 1996, Sunday, October the 13th, 5 years before you joined the business, share with the listeners what happened.
Sure. Well, it's, it's certainly the highlight of my life, and it was an unexpected surprise, but I became a Christian. There's no way of dressing it up or down, nor do I want to dress it down. Or dress it up. It's authentic. It's a very real thing that happened to me. I was 19 years old at the time. I suppose I'd hit the buffers on one level. You know, I had a wonderful family business down the line, but I'd nailed all my colors to the mast as far as not going to university, which in those days perhaps was a good thing. I'm not sure today it's necessarily such a good thing. All of my friends, the school expectation on leaving was that you would go to university. And I wanted to join the army to be an officer, but really to be on the front line. That was my, the physical side of the army was where I was coming from. So I looked into two regiments, got buy-in, and then you have to do the RCB, which gets you into Sandhurst. And I failed. And I had made such a big deal of this whole thing that it was a bit of a shock and quite sort of humiliating, really. They just didn't think I was quite right for being an officer. And I think probably they were right, actually. It wasn't my bag, but it sent me into this, what do I do now? I don't want to join the family business. You know, off the back of failing something, that doesn't look so good. And university really wasn't for me. And the world was a smaller place in those days, you know, we're 30 years ago almost. And I went to Oxford to do a course to get me into the army, even though it was pretty futile. I wasn't going to get in from what they told me, but I fudged it with my parents and I said, look, if I do a course, let's see what there is. It might help me with the current affairs, the officer requirements, what they're looking for, and see if it can get me going. And so I did a makeshift course for 3 months at an A-level college in Oxford. And my sister, Olivia, was at university there. She got the brains. She was studying theology because a year earlier, and she's a year older than me, but at the time, a year earlier, she had had an experience where out of the blue, she had become a Christian. Now, Liz, we were Christians. We were nominal Christians, I should say. You know, we went to church, submarine Christianity, you could call it, popping up on Christmas Day, go to church, maybe Easter Day. But not a great deal more than that. I think I did have a reverence for God, but I certainly didn't have anything personal going on, didn't realize it was actually real. And so I had this awareness or respect, but nothing very much more until I met Olivia, went to her church service on that day in Oxford. And I was at the back of the service, age 19, on the one hand, having fluffed it in one area of my life with the army. On the other hand, I was quite an accomplished drummer. There was a band playing in the church, which I thought was a bit cheesy. It was quite ahead of its time, but an overhead projector rather than a hymn book. So with the acetate, you remember moving around the words and you get it lined up. We're in 1996 now. And so I had 10 minutes being cynical. Drummer wasn't very good. Weird not having hymn books. People had their hands in the air, worshipping God. I felt it was all a bit strange. And I just had this moments inside where I thought, either I'm cynical for the next hour or hour and a half, and I just thawed out inside. I thought, no, I do believe there's a God. And as soon as I opened my heart, as it were, it was like the lights just went on and the love of God just flooded me. Like seeing a beautiful sunset or a nice piece of music. It's very hard to describe, but it was like real. It wasn't just going to be a sunset that then disappears. It was like, I know this is God. I mean, it was like it was hardwired into me, but I hadn't ever recognized it before. And from that point on, my life completely changed. I ended up going to a Bible school, like a theological college in London. might be saying too much. Met my wife without knowing it. We got married about 5 years later, but we were at the same course. Not much happened until about 2 or 3 years later, and we got married 5 years later. And I, then worked in the church, and I had really 5 or 6 years almost in that scene of church. And I thought, do I get ordained into the church and tell people who already know every Sunday? Or do I go into the workplace where people don't know this message, which I found out and I'm very grateful I did. And that was my kind of reckoning to then saying to my father, let's have breakfast. Would you like me for a year? Could I possibly look at it? And we've never looked back since. So I joined the business at the end of it.
And it's interesting because it obviously was the cotton wool that you needed to give you the confidence in order to sort of decide, you know, and I think that it's very important that everybody has a guiding light, for want of a better word, in life, whatever that may be. And I like this because I think that any religion, if it's followed and established and not to an extreme extent or whatever, but it gives you a base, it gives you a family base. I mean, I'm Jewish and I'm not religious, but I'm traditional. And when I brought up my children on my own for 8 or 9 years before I remarried, they were never allowed out on a Friday night. We had Friday night dinner, we lit the candles, we said the prayers, we had the roast chicken, and it bonded the family together. And I think that's what religion does. So you had breakfast with your father, and then 5 years later, you then joined the family business.
Yeah.
What level did you come into the business at?
Yeah, so I was 24, I think. I'd been married a couple of years and our son was just born at the same time. So I was junior. I mean, I grew up with jewelry, as far as that's an issue or an interesting point. You know, on the one hand, I grew up with it. On the other hand, it was all very new to me joining the business. It's one thing hearing about something. It's another thing then getting involved. So I worked on the shop floor.
And were you in Liverpool, Jody, then? Because I know head office was in Liverpool.
Yeah, you're right. And that's where I am today. And that is still head office for a long time, 200 and something years. But no, I was in one of our London branches. We've got 5 shops in London.
Where are the stores? Just share with the listeners where the stores are.
Yeah, sure. So we're in Bond Street, which is our flagship. And that's about to move, upgrade the other side of the street, but a much bigger presence. I mean, what we have is pretty special, but that's we've got an opportunity. So big move coming up. New Bond Street. And then, so that's the first. The second is Sloane Street, which is where I started. We've got Harrods, where we've been for almost 30 years in the fine jewellery hall there. Pretty special. Every jeweller in the world of serious note is in there. Royal Exchange over in Bank, which is a lovely, lovely shop in the office. That's obviously gone some change in the last 4 or 5 years since people haven't gone back to work, but we're still doing pretty well there. And then the Savoy Hotel. So they have one shop inside the hotel and it's a jewellery shop and it's ours.
And then you've got Liverpool and you've got Manchester. Am I right in thinking you've got Chester, or have I got that wrong?
Well done, exactly that. And then we also have Dublin, which is where I was, Kirsty, my wife and I. We lived there for 3 years to set it up in 2006. So
it's my favourite city, Dublin. What would you say the most challenging thing is about working in a family business?
I think it's remaining focused and it's having everybody buy into what really matters, like the key parts. We don't want to be, because we have more and more family joining. My father, Nicholas, and my uncle, Michael, they're 10 years apart. So, you know, my father's the oldest. He's now president. We're running out of titles. My uncle is the chairman and has recently handed the business over to my cousin, James, and me. And I think, so there's 4 of us, but then there's also James and me, we have 2 cousins, they're twins, boy and a girl, Geordie and Honor, they're our cousins, but you know, they're 20 years younger than us. So in their late 20s, and they have they're a different generation. Obviously, so are we, James and I, compared to those above us. But I think the 4 of us running the business, or James and I running it alongside or underneath Michael and my father for some time, we were on the same page. We now still are on the same page. We've got a very different generation below us. And I think the bits that are important as you grow as a family business are, what are we all about? What are we trying to deliver? Who are we? What's the core DNA? Because if you've got that focus, everything answers itself. Do we want to go overseas? Do we want to go lower end in jewelry? Are we looking for more shops, less shops? Who's our customer? What type of events are we to do? everything is really going to be answered by that goal as to who we are fundamentally. And I think you know that after 20 years with your uncle and your father, but suddenly with the newcomers coming in, it's not that they don't get it. It's just that we want to make sure it's embedded so that we don't go off-piste.
I think it's interesting that it's very difficult actually to accept the views and opinions of a younger generation. And I have that in my business. I mean, my setup is much smaller, but our client base, yours and mine, is probably very similar because you're dealing with high net worth individuals. But, you know, they're now talking about artists that we're booking for events that I've never heard of. You know, I'm still listening to Louis Armstrong or Andrea Bocelli or whoever it is. But I think that the combination, once the ethos is right and once they what they don't understand is how difficult it is to make money. And I don't say that with any greed or any, you know, but it's very difficult to make money. And I think that's what the younger generation don't see. And I think the combination of the experience and the business is hugely important. In my event business, I'm often asked what I think sets me apart from my competitors. What do you think sets Boodles apart from their competitors?
I think probably the word is relationship. I mean, it's all good and well for me to say that, but I think it is the backbone of our business. We get to know our customers. We actually really care. I mean, we care about business, but we connect. We're very fortunate. We're selling something nobody needs. It's at the very end of luxury. I mean, you could say a handbag for $30,000. It's come into the spotlight recently, isn't it? But that is something which is a necessity, but at that value, no, sure, you can buy a handbag for £500 and it's lovely. But you could spend £30,000, you'd probably spend a lot more. A car might be a necessity. You'd spend £20,000 or you'd spend £120,000. I think jewelry, you just don't need it. It's at the very, very end of the line. And so I'm constantly asking myself, how do we do it? And it is, we're selling a dream. We are selling an investment, medium and long term. It's actually proven to be a pretty good investment. Pink Diamond's an exceptionally good investment. It's actually outperformed every other commodity the last 20 years. But for our customers, they're clever people. They've run businesses, they've sold businesses, or they're very successful in their business, and they're able to come in and spend either a bit of money or quite a bit of money on something that at the end of the day, they don't need, they want it. It's a desire, it's a luxury, uber luxury. And so I think the relationship has to be a part of it so that they enjoy the experience of buying it. I mean, why are they buying it? It looks lovely, sure. The end product is stunning. The brand is recognized, as other big brands are. But I think where we excel compared to our competitors is that we talk about six star. We talk about the heart, which sounds a bit naff, but we're talking about, you know, are you serious about what you're doing? Are you serious about the customer who comes in, caring about people, looking at them, noticing them? Yes, wanting to sell a piece of jewelry to them, but it can be a medium and long term game. It's, you know, we often, someone will come in, they might come in three or four times before they buy something. But once they buy at Boodles, they tend to be a repeat long-term customer.
That's what I was going to say, because I think there's two things. I think trust is huge. Trust and respect are huge, whatever commodity you're selling, whether it's an intangible service or whether it's an item or whatever. And I also think, I believe, it's not about that sale, whether that sale be a 50th birthday party or a pink diamond, but it's about the sale that will come after that. And I think that is so, so important. And I think a lot of people miss that. You know, you go in and, yeah, you develop these relationships and you trust them so that somebody will say, actually, you know what? Don't buy that watch because Piaget are bringing out something in the autumn and I think that you'll like that better. And I think those sorts of conversations, they build the business, because I would imagine that your business has been built on repeat business, not just on new business. And it's very interesting. I could talk about this for ages and ages and ages, because I'm
this is not necessarily a good thing. I think it's a bit of a concern as well as a positive for us. But what percentage, Liz, do you think of our sales last year were to existing customers?
I would probably say about 87%.
Ooh, well done. It's 90.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. I thought you might have said 60 and thought you pushed it too far.
No.
Wow, very clever. Well, there you are. Is yours 87? Am I guessing events?
No, mine's 60. No, but it sounds so to me...
It's a good thing. It's a good thing and a bad thing. It's great because we've got customers. I mean, how good is business? It's got to be the next question. Because if it wasn't very good and you had 90%, that's because you haven't got any new customers coming through.
Well, no, I think, Jodie, there's two things here because we're going to get on to COVID in a minute. But I also think when I say 87%, some of that repeat business must be to their children. Or so I come in as a mother. I've bought from you for however many years, and I've got a daughter in my 30s, and I'm bringing her in for a gift. So that obviously would include new business, but I that's what I would think. Yeah, I'm glad I got that spot on. See?
Well, you're 3% hours.
All right. Okay. Another event that I have here that was very significant to you was in 2010 when you went on your first buying trip to New York. Now, am I right in thinking that you were expected to come back with 30 or 40 diamonds and you didn't? Tell us about it.
Yeah. Well, I was probably a bit wet behind the ears, but I had a passion. I mean, I've always had a passion for gemstones and diamonds. It's that bit when you join a business, you hit the ground running. So I'd always... You know, Dad would come in the old days and ask me, what do you think this is? What weight? What value? And he'd show me a diamond in his briefcase. Those were the days where we were allowed to carry jewelry around with us. He was good at getting my eye in very naturally and practically. And I went on one or two trips with him. But he said, go and see what there is in New York. And I had a budget. And you're dead right. I probably should have come back with 30, 40, 50 stones. Okay, maybe 20. I came back with two. I blew the budget purposefully, by the way, but only just blew it on two stones. And my feeling was we haven't ever had a stone like either of these. It was one in particular. And so on that particular trip, I blew it on these two stones. And the reason for it was one of them was a diamond you're never, ever going to see again. So I could not buy it. It was a octagonal cut, a bit like what we call an Asher cut or a square emerald cut, but it was different. It had almost every corner was as the same length. Very unusual, and it was like looking into a kaleidoscope. An incredible diamond, totally captivating. It was D-flawless, 8.5 carats. Really just, I thought, if I come back with this, everybody's going to be like, what is that? That's amazing. It's beautiful. And you wouldn't ever need to teach anybody about passion or get passionate about jewelry. That just spoke for itself. But then from the same person, and bear in mind, I'd see 6 or 7 people on those trips. I went to 6 or 7 places and I went back and I thought, I've got to buy that 10 carat yellow from the same person I bought the 8.5 carat octagonal cut. So I bought two stones, which blew the bank.
Did you sell them?
Yeah, this is 2010. We do have things for a period of time sometimes, but we sold the yellow diamond to a very good customer.
How much for?
Over £1 million. Both of them over £1 million. Each one was over more than £1 million. Yeah, and the other one took a little longer, but it did sell, funnily enough, in Ireland. So there we are.
I wish somebody had bought me a 10-carat yellow diamond. I've had 3 husbands, Jodie, and not got one bloody thing from any of them. The only diamond I bought, I had to buy myself. But anyway, hey-ho, there's still life in the old dog yet, as they say. Now, look, we've got to discuss COVID because I know how it's affected me. But yours wasn't just on a professional level. You shared with me a very personal experience during COVID that was significant to you and Kirsty. And I want you to tell the listeners what that was.
Sure. Well, I mean, you asked me for 3 or 4 things that made me. That's what this series is called. And we are what we are because of things that happen to us and how we respond to them, probably those two things. And, you know, you can't control the things that happen to you, but you can control how you react and respond. And everybody had a hard time, or most people had a hard time in COVID. My situation was, and I have to be quite honest about this, really, because otherwise it's too nuanced or cryptic. I didn't buy into the COVID narrative from day one. I thought there's something wrong with it. My gut just didn't go with it. So, you know, there's more and more people talking like that today. At the time, it was not that many of us. And we were sort of outed as pure conspiracy theorists. And I just thought, well, it doesn't, I'm very happy to go along with something if I feel comfortable and I didn't feel comfortable. So I had that going on one level, just a sort of a dis-ease in my being about what's happening here. And I got COVID, and actually my wife, Kirsty, was in hospital, which she realized afterwards was COVID, in 2019, November. She missed all of our Christmas shows. So she was in hospital for 12 days, very ill. So I'm not denying COVID was there, but I didn't buy the whole narrative about what's happening, how's it, you know, a bat and all that sort of stuff. Just didn't feel right for me. So it wasn't comfortable. Then the business was shut down because of the lockdowns. So that was another pinch point of stress. And then our middle son, we have three children, and the middle son is now absolutely flying. And I realize it's not everybody's case. There'll be people listening who are in their challenge and they haven't come out of it. And I would say to you listening that are in that place, hold fast and pray. By the way, I mentioned my Christianity earlier. What happened with our middle son was he just didn't do well with it. He's always quite a handful. He's always very dynamic, a bit of a one-off. And he just went off-piste. He doesn't mind me saying some things, other things that I respect that I don't want to be sort of giving airtime to. But he was 15, 16 at that time, stuck at home, hadn't done brilliantly well at school, and things weren't going well. So I'll probably just leave it there. But he was having a very, very difficult time. It's all happening in our house. And that has a bearing on the marriage. You know, of course it does. And also on the other siblings. So his elder brother and his younger sister, our other two children, become quite complicit when there's one kid causing a lot of trouble. One tries to appease mum and dad, make sure everything's fine. That's the older son's role. And the other one just goes very quiet. So we didn't have much time, space, energy, and there was a lot of stress with the business being closed down, and then just thinking this whole thing is not right anyway. What's really happening? It was just a sort of whirlwind that caused a lot of stress. And I found myself, when we finally opened the business again after the first lockdown, going to Sloane Street and having straight down to London. I hadn't seen the Sloane Street shop since kind of early December. So they had been the one shop I'd not seen really for four months. January, certainly all of January, but a bit of December as well, January, February, March, and April when we opened up. So I said to our manager, I'll be straight down to see you, top priority. Had breakfast in the shop. They did a nice little salmon and boiled eggs. It was first day back after lockdown, so there's sort of a lot to celebrate. It was a lovely sunny day, and I had a phone call from my wife, 9 o'clock. I got the early train, as I usually do, 9 o'clock in the shop with them having breakfast, and it rang Kirsty. I thought she wouldn't be ringing me if there wasn't something going on. That seemed to be where, remember, that being the point. So I took the phone call outside, and it was our middle son really kicking off, and Kirsty in pieces, and just thinking, because we were at the end of the road, but it's not in our marriage, but maybe also actually in some ways, now I look back at it, I think we were really struggling. And when you get down to, I always say, when you hit rock bottom, you find the rock at the bottom. And Jesus said, I am the rock on which to build your house. You remember that parable? He is the rock at the bottom. And I really cried out. I actually slightly freaked out. For me, I wouldn't say I'm too demonstrative, but I walked out of the shop and I just had a moment where I was just really just upset. And I thought, am I having a breakdown? Is this what a breakdown looks like? But all I knew is I am not doing very well. I'm really stressed out. I'm really struggling. I'm meant to be back to work. It should be a good thing. We're coming out of this thing. And I feel like I've collected 4 months of stress and worry. And it's not just finishing by the fact that this lockdown is now over. And so I got straight back on a train, back up. And that was the beginning of the start of our marriage getting much better. We did marriage therapy, but every Friday afternoon, I'll end by saying this because it could be a long story. There's a guy called Will, I'll keep his surname out of it, who I've known for 15 years, I should think, not very well. He's a coach. He's a psychologist. He's a very bright guy, but he's also done a little bit of work in businesses. And I got an email from Will as I was on the train going back home to sort out the next wave of problems that seemed to be happening. I got an email from Will just completely out of the blue. I hadn't heard from him for years, actually. Just saying, Jody, I hope the lockdown wasn't too bad. Ha ha, it was awful. I'm getting into the workplace a little bit more and not just doing one-to-one sort of therapy and coaching and what have you, life coaching. If there's any need in business, in the wider business, let me know. I thought, flipping it, well, I need him for myself, let alone the company. When I got home, the dust settled a bit. Kirsty and I sat down, had a cup of tea and talking about things. And I had an email from Will today. He was telling me that he'd like to get involved in the business if we want to. And I think he needs to help me. And she said, how interesting. I had a dream last night about Will as well. Same person. So, and that's often how God does speak. Now I see it. Coincidence is a coincidence until you think, actually, maybe there's a creator and he loves us. And so that all starts to come in for me. So I called him and I met him every Friday at 5 o'clock, regardless of where I was, on Zoom for a year. And I hate therapy, navel gazing, don't want faffing around. I'd rather just get on with life. But I'd hit the bottom so hard that I thought, I've got to sort, how do I sort my son out? The first session was, I said to Will, look, Will, here's what's going on. Business, marriage is tricky. COVID, I don't really know what the truth is and all of this stuff. And really, the main thing is my middle son. I just really think I need your help to sort him out. And he said, well, why don't we try and look at sorting you out? And then we might come on to your son. And we just spent a year of him helping me, going through the gears a bit more slowly, how to handle life when there are problems. You're always going to have problems. How do you live with them and make peace with the fact that there are problems that you can't always solve? I love ticking things off and getting things done and out of the way. And you just can't simply get everything done. There was a lot of reflection in there, and it was just getting my cadence back in line, which then led on to, you know, I think we'll do some marriage counseling. So I found somebody else for that. That was on a Monday at 3 o'clock, and it had to be with my wife on Zoom, but I had to be with her. And I thought, well, I can't commit to Mondays at 3 o'clock. That's like Monday, and I could be anywhere in the world. I mean, it's like, well, sorry, the counselor said, if you're not prepared to do that, then you want to think about how serious your marriage is. It's Monday at 3 o'clock. That's all I can do to fit you in. Let me know if you think you can make it work. And I was like, so I had to sort of own up to the other family members. Look, guys, I'm having a bit of a rough time at the moment, and I need to have Mondays at 3 o'clock at home because I can't even be in my office on Zoom with my wife on Zoom at home. They wanted us together because then, you know, afterwards we had to do various things to talk. And it was the best. That was probably 6 months. It was invaluable. It was brilliant. It got me talking and So I think that was the making. If your foundation is firm, you'll weather any storm. If your foundation is not firm, and when things shake, you start to see, well, where's it not very firm? And so that's what you have to deal with. And I think what's
brilliant is that you actually invested in yourself, because it would have been very easy to say, well, you know, my son's this, my son's that, he needs this and he needs that. But actually, when you look at yourself and invest in yourself, I'm a great believer in therapy. I think it's the best. I've been having it for 6 years, and I'm told by my staff now, tell me I no longer need anger management, and also there's a great book by Mel Robbins which I listened to in the car on the way to work. I'm on second time round. It's called Let Them. It's the Let Them Theory. It's excellent because it just allows you to let go of a lot of the things that eat you up inside. And I assume now that your son is good.
Yeah, my son is now missionary, aged 20, in Mexico. He's been there for a year and a bit.
I'm loving it.
Yeah, I mean, the Christianity bit was kind of like icing on the cake. But I mean, the cake was his whole life, and he knows what we think about God, and he's had his own views. But you can't turn someone's lights on. You have to have those lights turned on off your own decision. So amazingly, he's leading groups. He's great. He's doing really well. But
fabulous.
We've come through the problem. Yeah.
Fabulous. Back to business. You are present at various events, which I love. You've got the Cheltenham Gold Cup. You've got Chelsea Flower Show. You've got Boodles Boxing. I am huge into brand. And what I love about this ethos is that it takes what could be perceived as unavailable into various arenas that people relate to. My friend owns Sofas and Stuff, which is a retail operation throughout the country. And he's associated himself with the arts, especially the V&A for fabric inspiration. I want to know where the inspiration comes from for your collaborations and collections. So I saw on an article that I was Googling somewhere, a really gorgeous ring. It was rose gold and it was white gold, and it sort of, and it was quite chunky. You can give it me if you want. And it looked a little bit like a pair of boxing gloves if I wanted it to look like. And I was very intrigued because you're very into collections at Boodles. And where does it come from? And why do you think, why do you align yourselves with these sort of events?
Sure. Two good questions. Well, the collections, we got a team of six designers headed up by Rebecca. She's brilliant. She will either have inspiration like the Rain Dance ring that's in the V&A Museum now. Interesting, it's been there for 20-something years, actually. The inspiration for that was, I think she was in Kew Gardens, I think. You'll have to look at the website, Kew Gardens, and she saw some water collecting off a leaf in droplets. And as they went down, the inspiration, if you look at our Rain Dance ring, you can see the sort of the flow of water and the droplets of the diamonds. So that was where that design came from. We then there's a collection built off Rain Dance in that look. The ring was first and the whole collection follows. But my grandmother died in, this is relevant to the collections, she died in 2020. And we cleared her house out. My cousin James, co-managing director, was helping to clear the house out. And he came across a photo album, which was my grandfather's. He died many years ago. And it had ticker tape. You remember that stuff? He used to ticker tape everything. Knives, fork. We had a little holiday flat down in Devon. It was sort of like literally knives, forks, front door, doorbell. I mean, he loved it. He went crazy with ticker tape. And on the outside of this old-fashioned photo album was his Around the World in 15 Days. Or is it 16 Days? Around the World in 16 Days. He did in 1970, and I'm so sorry, I should have the details in front of me. It was something like 1975, I think. He went on a business trip around the world in 16 days. And inside the album, there's pictures of him, Mikimoto's grandson, buying pearls in Japan. Then he was in Hawaii, where there are no gemstones. We were a little bit curious about how long he was there for out of his 16 days. But he was buying gemstones for 16 days at the Red Fort of India. And James is very good like this. He heads up the marketing side. He thought, I wonder whether Nicholas, my father, grandfather's son, whether he'd do an inspirational trip around the world or part of the world with Rebecca, the designer, on and off. She could come up and visit here and there to look at designs and get a collection in memory of my grandfather based on a similar idea of going around the world in 16 days. And I think Dad did it in 10 days, but he went around Europe. And so we had Venice, Geneva, different cities he went to. There was a design based on either the famous museum or on the lake, or different inspiration which Rebecca took from those cities, and we made a collection. And so we've always done something kind of wow, and those are all wow pieces. You know, we're talking about 20, 25 pieces in these sorts of collections, and the title of them is Wonderland. So we have the Wonderland theme is these one-off collections. We're just about to launch Africa. My father actually again went to South Africa, Tanzania, Kenya last year with a videographer, an amazing videographer actually, who's a bit of a friend as well. So there's a film that's going to come out with this. But the inspiration that came back from this was from photos of different landscapes, the Blue Train, you know, the Cullinan Diamond Mine, various different places that they went to, and these incredible African designs are about to be launched in June this year.
Which is your favourite collection?
Well, I want to go back and just say that I actually think B Boodles is very, very us. We, as in B-E Boodles. B Boodles, a bit like Rain Dance, is one collection that all of our 10 shops have at any one point in time. They'll have a full collection of each. But Rain Dance is also stunning. I mean, I get excited. I've just got back from Antwerp. I was in Antwerp with four of our top customers, who we flew out there and gave just a bit longer than 24 hours in Antwerp, meeting the founder of the Argyle Pink Diamond Mine, produced 85-90% of the world's pink diamonds. And we've got a very strong relationship and a sort of a partnership. The mine closed after 38 years in 2020, and pink diamonds, which I mentioned, outperformed any other commodity in the last 20 years. I think it probably will continue to do so. The mine's depleted, but there's still a few stones that they've held back. We have a sort of an agreement with them. And I said to Patrick Coppens, the CEO, who established the mine 40-something years ago and rolled it up 3 years ago, but it takes about 5 years to close it down properly. Could we bring some top customers? I'd love you to speak to them, show them how the process works. The Diavik mine is a white diamond producing mine in Canada, which they also operate, which is built under a lake. Extraordinary engineering, how they right up near the right up in the Northern Territories. And some of their ice, those ice roads that you've probably seen on TV late at night, that was all filmed on their ice roads going to their mines up in the Northern Territories. So you know, you get the gist of how that temperature is and what the environment is. It would be fascinating, Patrick, if we could bring them out to hear you talk about it and see some diamonds. So we did that. Very successful trip. Great fun. Beautiful hotel. But the... You know, I think next year there may be something off the Diavik mine, an inspirational collection that comes from Diavik. So it's things like this as we go out. And I always say to our team, you know, what is in your hands? What is in your hands? What is at hand? What can you grasp hold of? Because if you have a good idea, it's probably something you can actually put action to quite quickly. You know, there's some great ideas that come around and you think, well, that's serious blue sky thinking, it's never going to happen. But we know Antwerp well. So my thinking was, well, what about taking it one step further? Rather than me going twice a year by myself, buying diamonds, why not take some customers? And we did. And it's deepened the relationship with two key diamond players out there. But
The listeners can't see you, but it's like somebody's just plugged you in because you're obviously so passionate about the diamonds and the stones. It's exciting to watch and to see, and I get it. I get it completely. What's the most expensive item that Boodles has ever sold? Are you allowed to share that or not? Well, I'm not asking unless he's single. If he's single, then tell me who it is.
No, he's not single. He's not single. I won't say he would die there. There's a couple. I think they both bought it together pretty much, but both in their own right, very wealthy. It was an Ashoka diamond, D-flawless, 31 carats, and it was £5 million. It was quite a few years ago.
And if you were to buy Kirsty one piece of jewellery, what would it be?
It would be the 2.06 carat vivid pink diamond that we have, which is £5 million. It's like no other pink diamond I've ever seen. It's got absolutely nothing wrong. Pinks always have something wrong with them. Pinks always have something wrong. They're either a bit too included or they're cut too deep, something to help the color push out. So there's compromise here and there. And that's acceptable with pinks, by the way. This doesn't have any issues. It's excellent polish, excellent symmetry. It's VS, so the clarity is clear. It's vivid, but it's not just vivid. You can get vivid and vivid. It's just as that's the category that's the Gemological Institute of America would give it. It's their highest grade. But even then, you can have like a, we talk about out of four. So is it a 1 out of 4 vivid or is it a 4? This is a 4.
Well, I hope that she's glad that she went to those 3 o'clock sessions on a Monday because it looks like there's light at the end of the tunnel. Kirsty, if you're listening to this, I think you might be in line for a £5 million flawless V&S diamond. Jodie, I could talk to you all day. I just find the whole thing fascinating. Yeah, I've just loved talking to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Oh, Liz, thanks ever so much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Events That Made Me. For more boardroom inspiration, make sure that you listen to my conversation with Jo Malone, CBE, to learn how she became a household name on a previous series of my podcast. I will be back with another conversation soon. In the meantime, do not forget to review the podcast, follow the podcast, and I'm on Instagram, Liz Taylor Consultancy.